Live from Botoni in New Zealand, this is the Cinematica podcast, your weekly guide to what's on at the movies. You can find this and other episodes of the show at cinematica.co.nz. Good evening. Good afternoon, good morning, wherever you may be. Once again, you've stumbled across the Cinematica podcast. This is a weekly roundup of reviews, news, and opinion about the world of cinema. It helps guide you through that dense jungle of latest releases, and we want you to get the best value out of your, for most people, ever-diminishing cinema dollar. My name is Dan Slevin, and joining me in the studio is...
Young Simon Weary.
And Kaylee Carruthers.
So, welcome. Every week we're here to review all the latest releases, talk to interesting people about what they've been watching, and keep a close eye on what's been happening around the world, films and stories that we're looking forward to. In this week's program, Kaylee will spin some beautiful lies about the latest Audrey Tautou film. I will bring Paranormal Activity 3 out of the murk. And with the help of special guest Miriam Ross, our 3D expert, we'll see whether Wim Wenders sweeps us off our feet with his new dance documentary, Pina. All that and more in this week's edition of the Cinematica podcast. But first, some follow-up from last week. I was listening back to the show, and I realised that in our discussion of the Three Musketeers, I confused the director of the Three Musketeers, P.W.S. Anderson, with P.T. Anderson. These are two completely different directors, ladies and gentlemen. So I want to apologise to both people, both men, both directors, for any offence that I may have caused, because this is, of course, the kind of error that does cause catastrophe at the video store, isn't it?
So which one is the one?
Well, the one that was responsible for the Three Musketeers that we so roundly panned last week is P.W.S. Anderson, and P.T. Anderson is responsible for films like Magnolia and There Will Be Blood, a different calibre altogether. So that was a big oops on my part, and for those of you that have listened to that podcast and wanted to slap me for that mistake, you can do that via the vehicle of Twitter. Cinematica Cast is our username at Twitter, so if we make a mistake while you're listening to this show, then let us know about it via Twitter.
Hashtag facelap.
Indeed. So, now that I've got that out of the way and I've done my penance, what have you been going to see this weekend? Here's Kaylee with the New Zealand Box Office Top 5.
Thank you very much, Dan. So, number 5 in New Zealand this week was The Three Musketeers.
Boo, yes.
Number 4 was Real Steel. Number 3, Johnny English Reborn. Number 2, Paranormal Activity 3, which Dan will be taking the reins on and talking about a little bit later. And number 1 is still The Smurfs.
And
Les Blues.
We should point out that to those listeners that are not based in New Zealand, that last weekend here in New Zealand was a weekend where most people did not go to the movies. It was, first of all, Labour weekend, public holiday, and Sunday night was the final of the Rugby World Cup where the All Blacks played France, and many cinemas around the country, in fact, gave up on showing movies and showed the rugby instead for free. Did you do that here, Simon?
No such luck. Actually, we all scampered off and watched it. So we shut our doors a little bit early. I must apologise to the one email I got about that, saying, where were you on Sunday night? We were actually at home watching the game.
So when you look at those that New Zealand top five, you can see why it hasn't really moved very much. That's because nobody released any new films last week.
And it's time to go back to the movies now.
It is, exactly. Life goes on, ladies and gentlemen. So, first off on the review agenda today is the new film starring Audrey Tautou. Is that how you pronounce it?
I believe it is.
Audrey Tautou, cool. And it's called Beautiful Lies.
Emily has a secret admirer.
Je ne vis que du bonheur de vous regarder. Vous me croisez parfois et vous ne savez pas que chaque frôlement est une souffrance.
But no time for romance.
Pourriez,
Oui, bien sûr.
Her mother has no one.
On a l'impression que tu viens de t'évader de l'asile.
But needs love more than ever.
Je sais que tu voudrais que je rencontre quelqu'un de bien qui m'aime. Ou même quelqu'un de pas bien.
That sounds like the worst film ever.
I don't think the voiceover over top of the French meshed with the English might be a little bit confusing to our listeners outside of French speaking countries. But if you want to go watch the trailer, it does have subtitles, and the film does have subtitles. Anyway.
And does Audrey Tautou play somebody else called Emily?
Yes. Emily with an E.
Ah.
Dumb A.
Still, it's a bit of a, it's making sure that point, that connection is well made for people, isn't it?
Yes. So what happens in the film is Emily, with an E, opens an anonymous love letter from an admirer, and she's tempted to throw it in the trash until she realizes how much the sentiment would mean to her lonely, depressed mother. Shenanigans ensue. You can imagine what happens.
Mistaken identity, perhaps?
No, not mistaken identity as we saw in Monte Carlo, but it left you with similar questions as we had last week with Monte Carlo. And the question is this what women are really like? Are there women out there who are this awful that they take a love letter, give it to their mother, deceive their mother, and end up breaking her heart?
I must admit that I have a really, really big problem with films where the premise is founded on people lying to each other as if that's a good thing.
Yeah.
You know, I just think that there's some value problems going on there. But it's French, so we'll give them a pass this time round. But what about is it funny?
No, it's not funny. It was actually, I didn't find it funny. I actually found it really sad and quite upsetting, actually. I found it not upsetting as it was an offensive, but just the whole knowledge and notion of just, the whole thing is about lying and tricking people, and it's just so sad.
Audrey Tautou, she's a favourite at the New Zealand box office, as we know from Emily, and is her presence here enough to sort of save the film, do you think?
Well, it's quite interesting because this is a character that I've not seen her play before, and she's a bit of a bad girl. She's quite selfish and quite kind of full of herself and very concerned with her job, and can drink a mean Smirnoff tequila or Smirnoff vodka.
She yeah, that Smirnoff tequila, that goes yeah, down yeah. super well, doesn't it? And I noticed, I haven't seen the film, obviously, hence I'm asking these really dumb questions, but I noticed from the trailer that there's a little bit of sort of cross-cultural stuff going on. The object of, or the guy who writes the love letter is North African or Algerian or something like that. Am I right? Does that even matter?
No, it doesn't matter. Okay. The thing that matters is his character is actually, he works in the salon doing maintenance work, but he's actually trained as an interpreter and he's very, very intelligent. And this becomes kind of this conflict between him and Emily because she's so afraid of his smarts. And
golly. It's getting better. Every detail that you reveal is bringing the horror to life. So Beautiful Lies is what it's called, and I mean even the title's pretty embarrassing, I have to say.
It definitely wasn't my slice of cheese, but you know there may be people out there who really like us. So you know, like it, not us. They might like us too. But.
And right, so I think we're talking. We disapprove. Of Beautiful Lies here at the Cinematica podcast. This is the first time that we've reviewed a film that I haven't seen, and I'm feeling really uncomfortable about that. So
I have power.
Yes, this is, I hate being in the dark on these things.
Yes, so I did not enjoy it, but please let us know what you thought of it if you do go to see it.
Indeed, and through the vehicle of the Twitter machine, if that's your preferred method of communicating with us. Next on the show, we're going to talk about 3D, film in three dimensions, and I would like to welcome our special guest for the show today. Dr. Miriam Ross is a lecturer in film at Victoria University and a world leader in the study of digital 3D technology. She's been looking into its effects on audiences and the movie business. And it's a pleasure to have her with us in the studio. Miriam, welcome.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk about 3D first. And I just want to ask you, what's in terms of your academic approach to the topic, what angles and approaches have you been taking with it?
A few different things. Partly an industry study just to see what's happening here with the huge emergence in the last 5 or 6 years of 3D cinema. what's, you know, it's making a lot of money. What does that mean for the business? Are we going to see more of these films? And particularly, how is this part of the history of 3D cinema, right? We've always had these booms and busts, and where is this one?
It's a fad, isn't it?
Well, that's what they'll say, but this is quite a lengthy fad right now. We're making a lot of money.
And it's not just making a lot of money, but it's costing a lot of money. That cinemas, if they're going to actually take part in this movement, shall we say, are having to invest in vast amounts of new equipment, and it's an expensive exercise, isn't it?
It is, but most of them that are upgrading to 3D are doing it so they can provide other digital content, and that's not going to go away. So the actual 3D is a bit of an add-on for them.
I've always felt, actually, that 3D was neither here nor there. It was kind of a stalking horse for me for getting rid of 35mm film, which is an ancient and archaic technology, and to replace it with pristine, beautiful, high-definition digital, which I prefer, actually, over film. And I know that here we are, this is a podcast called Cinematica, and we love going to the movies, and probably people think that I should be absolutely in love with the sort of clackery sound of that you hear from the projection box of film going through projectors, but I don't, actually.
Yeah, I like the romance of the clatter in the film, and it's been a very hard transition to make, going from film to digital, I'm sure, for a lot of, you know, exhibitors. But I think it's that consistency of offer. It's consistently right every time. And that's 6-8 weeks, you know, 3 months down the line. But you're right, it's primarily about a conversion to digital, and 3D has been that lever to drive that.
It's also pushing movie theatre growth across the world. So you've got Latin America as a growth region, so it's China. And it's really 3D's bringing audiences. It's allowing them to build movie theatres. It's allowing them to get new people as audience members.
And for Hollywood, I think we underestimate, don't we, how important the international non-English speaking market is for Hollywood, and you know what a proportion of Hollywood box office comes from overseas. And do we count New Zealand as overseas? I suppose we're not quite the one of those markets that absolutely sort of falls in love with Jean-Claude Van Damme movies or Nicolas Cage, isn't he? Nicolas Cage is actually is an example of somebody who simply would not be a star if it was just for the US market alone. So, yeah.
There's also the drive against piracy. I mean, New Zealand's not too much of a threat, but China, a huge threat in the piracy market. And 3D is the one thing the pirates right now can't crack.
That's right. It's pretty difficult with a camcorder at the back of the movie theatre, isn't it, to capture a 3D movie. In fact, actually, you know, they were so wobbly, those camcorder recordings, that they actually looked kind of vaguely 3D, didn't they? They were so shaky. Are you also in your studies of 3D? Are you also examining, I guess, the effect on audiences and why 3D would be an attractive way of presenting a story?
Yeah, it's a big aspect, especially because there's not been a history of academics working this area. So academics are very good at looking at what happens with a normal 2D film, and what it says about audience relationships with screen, with characters, with narrative. And no one's really done it for 3D, so it's of interest. And it's also interesting because rather than talk about Tapina, we've suddenly got art house 3D films emerging, and that's an exciting new step.
That's right. I remember when I first reviewed Beowulf back in 2007, which was the first 3D major Hollywood release, and I remember comparing it actually to The Jazz Singer. Because, you know, I felt like I was in the presence of something new that was going to change everything. But, you know, like The Jazz Singer, it wasn't much of a film. But it showed the way for something in the future. And I very much got the sense that at some point an artist was going to get hold of the technology and do something interesting with it. Since then, we've been waiting quite a long time.
We have been, but that's the exciting thing about digital technology, not just obviously screening technology, but the fact that filmmakers such as Wim Wenders, but even more importantly, Werner Herzog, they've made these 3D films on quite a modest budget. They've been able to do it without even huge studio backing.
And Herzog, he made most of the 3D in Cave of Forgotten Dreams was shot on domestic 3D, like the kind of stuff you could go to Harvey Norman's and buy. I mean,
he had to make his own rig, and he was very upfront about that and said, yeah, look at this, we couldn't get big cameras in here, so we've stuck some things in kind of bronze.
And it's not just the likes of Herzog and Wenders, but the new Martin Scorsese film that's going to be it's been shot in 3D and will be available in 3D. And Francis Coppola, who once he realized that actually his vineyard was so successful that he didn't have to work again, he's decided to go back to filmmaking purely for his own amusement in some ways. And so he's gone back to making some very strange art house movies, and his most recent film is in 3D. So I think that says something interesting, that was a filmmaker of major reputation choosing to use 3D, not because of commercial pressures or studio pressures or anything like that, simply because that's how he wanted to present his film. I remember reading an article by Roger Ebert talking about 3D, because Ebert has probably been one of the loudest anti-3D voices, eh? And he was talking about how he when he goes to see a film, he wants to see something like a window, and he wants to look through a window. He doesn't want people sticking their hands out of the window and poking him in the eye with it. So there is a lot of resistance, and apart from Ebert, where is that resistance coming from, do you think?
I think it's a lot of critics who see film as an art medium, and it should be about story, it should be about narrative, and a lot of people that just don't like the spectacular, so they're quite happy to criticise your traditional blockbuster where you have things flying around left, right and centre, and for them 3D is just an extension of the power of the blockbuster to dazzle and awe audiences rather than engage intellectually.
Yeah, it's that fad once again, or the roller coaster ride, the carnival aspect of. But
there also have been some kind of 3D knockoffs, haven't there? That have maybe not made the market too sort of welcoming to other sort of 3D films. I mean, I think their process is quite important in terms of how they convert or produce 3D films, and there have been a few
That was what I was going to ask about, that because that's the 3D brand has definitely been damaged by those conversions.
Yeah, there was the Clash of the Titans and Alice in Wonderland, kind of one after each other, and they got slated. So there's a lot of work going on right now in the industry to try and make sure if they do conversions, if they put more money into it, they make it more effective. But you're also talking about movies that they're not going to be good movies anyway.
Mm-hmm. True, but you look at things like Titanic coming out and Star Wars, and they're my like very emotional favourites, and to see them possibly kind of converted and not converted well would be quite a big disappointment. Are you seeing trends? Are you seeing box office results or trends that are sort of indicating that the audience is getting a bit savvy, that sort of thing?
Well, the difficulty is there's a lot of reports, industry reports, getting made up, but there's so many different variables going on right now, especially because in any given city you might have a certain number of 3D films being shown, sometimes 2D films, and so audiences are maybe deciding because they want to see 3D, or they might just be deciding, well, the 2D time is a better time for me, or the price is higher, or actually that 3D screening is sold out, so I go to 2D, and there's so many different things happening that it's really hard to get straightforward analysis.
I used to think that because I watched so many films and I was watching so many 3D films that I could tell the difference between a converted film and a film that was shot natively. I thought that I was so sort of onto it. And I remember watching, was it Step Up 3D? Was that a conversion or was that a...
No, Step Up 3D was filmed in...
Yeah, and I was absolutely sure that that was a conversion. I remember in my review saying, this is one of the worst examples of 3D I've ever seen. It felt to me that it looked like all of the characters in it were like those two-dimensional cardboard cutouts that people used to slide along in their puppet theatre, their toy theatre. And yet now you're telling me that I'm wrong and it was actually shot in 3D, and I should just shut up about that because I obviously don't know what I'm talking about.
Well, the difficulty is the lines getting really, really blurred now because of post-production. And there's a huge amount of films. Transformers was a great example. There's so much CGI content that a lot of it wasn't filmed live-action in 3D. So it was a live-action 3D film that was filmed in 3D processes, but actually there's an awful lot of shots in there that weren't being blurred in post-production. So it's becoming harder and harder for the eye to tell,
When I watched that first example, Beowulf, the strongest feeling that I took away from that film was that by putting those glasses on, and this was the Dolby 3D where the glasses were big and heavy and they sat right over the top of my ordinary spectacles, and I watched them and I thought, at last, this has made the rest of the audience go away. It was, and it wasn't that the film was particularly involving. It was simply that unless somebody's phone actually rang beside me, I wasn't aware of them anymore. And that's what proved to me that I thought, oh, the 3D, there's a wave of the future here.
Well, it's interesting because there is the other backlash in 3D. People do not like putting on glasses. If you don't wear glasses, it seems cumbersome. But there was something arrived at that time, but even still happening with Avatar onwards, where it became an experience that people bought the glasses in the foyer and they put them on and showed them to their friends and put them on top of their head and took them off. And it was kind of, it all added to that idea of we're going to the cinema, not just sitting at home.
Indeed, they're collector's items, aren't they? Some of those 3D glasses. Did you guys ever get to see the Harry Potter, the special Harry Potter?
Yeah, special Harry Potter.
And Ian Freer, who is a Wellington cinema tech of some renown, managed to get me a pair of clip-ons, which are very cool, and they make a big difference because then there's no frame to get in the way. So it really, it does feel like it's, you know, it's all just presence.
And it's just one more of these variables, because even here in Wellington, the difference between the 3D glasses you get at the Reading Cinema and the real 3D ones you get at the Embassy, much nicer at the Embassy, they're lighter, the ones, and I just think you get a worse 3D experience in the Reading. There's something about the polarization system they're using that just doesn't feel good.
Well, that's maybe a debate that we can have in a future episode, because I know that film technicians and film technologists have a very strong preference for the Dolby Digital 3D, which is the big glasses that Reddings have. They think that there's something purer about the quality of the 3D, even though there's so much light gets lost through the lenses and what have you. So I think we might hold that for another time.
One thing you might see, or you will see, is purpose-built cinemas that are digitally focused that aren't, you know, where you might be seeing some issues is possibly over the conversions that have taken place in those cinemas to get to a position where you can put on that avatar and all that sort of thing. And perhaps, you know, later on down the line, cinemas are going to have to invest even more heavily in terms of the whole experience and getting that digital sort of experience spot on, and from the grassroots up.
Yeah, well, just to add to that, here in Wellington, Reddings, which is the big commercial multiplex in the centre of town, has just rebranded one of their cinemas, and I can't remember what they're called, but it's some fanboy. It looks like it's a video game. One of those places where you go and shoot your mates with paintballs, but it's or it's a comic book or something like that. It's something XT or anyway, Cinema One has basically been given a bit of a zhuzh up, and they've got Dolby Digital there. It requires two projectors to get enough light on the screen to make the thing work. They've added a whole lot of new speakers. They're really pushing this as a sort of ultimate excitement machine. But one of the problems with doing that is that they push out so much sound that you can hear the contents of that cinema all the way through, all the way down the corridor through cinemas 2, 3, and 4. And, you know, it's like what you were saying, Simon, is that cinemas are going to have to think about whether they do complete refurbs for soundproofing, for all sorts of things in order to preserve the experience for those people who aren't in that particular cinema. There's a lot of aspects to these developments that we haven't reached the end of yet. Anyway, let's talk about 3D specifically, and in a moment we'll talk about Wim Wenders' Peanut. It's a selection of music from the soundtrack of the Wim Wenders film Pienaar, which is now playing in Wellington and in Auckland. And I think it's going to be travelling around the country as October and November goes on. It was a big hit in the Wellington Film Festival, the New Zealand International Film Festivals. And one of the reasons for asking you to come here, Miriam, was because of your 3D experience. And I know that you've seen Peanaar a couple of times, haven't you? So what's your impression of it?
I think the first thing that struck me when seeing it at the International Film Festival here was actually about audiences, because I watched it in the Embassy Theatre. It was sold out. And they have the real 3D glasses always have a little kind of insert trailer for their 3D glasses at the beginning. They say, please put on your 3D glasses now. Sort of digital jog kind of comes out the screen. At that point, almost everybody in the movie theatre all gasps in excitement because they've clearly never seen a 3D film in the cinema before. And so it's a completely new audience.
It's quite buzzy when that happens, isn't it? Yeah. When you know, sometimes it's when kids put them on for the first time and they start reaching out, don't yeah. they? To try and grab stuff coming out of the screen. But when it's grown-ups at an art house movie getting that same level of excitement, that's always pretty nice too. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little bit about what the film is about and why vendors would be wanting to make this particular subject.
Well, it's an interesting story because Vendors was a film, a friend of Pinabash, a choreographer, a German choreographer, very famous for implementing new types of dance. And he'd wanted to film her work for a long time and said to her, I just can't figure out a way how to film your work. It's really beautiful, but I don't know how to do it. And then he saw, I think it was some of the Avatar stuff from James Cameron, and ran back to Pina and said, I've cracked it. The only way I can possibly do your dance justice on screen is through 3D. Somebody film in 3D. She agreed. They set up the whole thing. And then really sadly, she died when they were in pre-production. And he was going to cancel the project until the dancers who were meant to be involved there in her company said, oh no, please, can we carry on with this? So the film was a result of two things. I mean, his love for Pinabash's work, but also the excitement that he could do something that he couldn't do otherwise, which is film in 3D. So it's a very beautiful film. What it doesn't have is any story. You're more or less watching a number of dance excerpts from her work interspersed with some little interviews with the dancers and the company. So in terms of your normal blockbuster audiences, this is not their 3D movie. There's no story to follow. But if you're a fan of dance or of just interesting visual forms, it's incredibly engaging.
Yeah, if you don't know anything about Pina herself or the history, it can be a little bit tough to follow. But I think ultimately by the end you do get enough facts about her history to be able to piece everything together. But you do have to concentrate throughout. What I really loved about it, I mean, I kind of knew that 3D cameras shooting dance on stage would work really well because you get to see the depth of a stage. And she used a really deep stage. She had right to the very back wall of the theatre. But what he also did was he took the dance and the dancers out of the theatres and into the community, the Wuppertal sort of city where the theatre was, and recreated the dances on the suspended monorail that they have there and in abandoned factories and quarries. And I really loved seeing dance in the real world as opposed to just on stage.
And the really exciting thing about the film is that you've got the close-ups in the dancers' bodies, the things that if you go through a live dance performance, no matter how close you are to the stage, you don't get that really intense detail, but you still got it in 3D, you still got the sense of the spatial configurations, and that was really exciting. So it's something that you can't see normal 2D dance in film, but you also can't see if you go to watch it in the auditorium.
I used to work for a ticketing company, and we made an interesting discovery in that at theatres that have two or three levels, for dance shows, the circle, which is somewhere above the stalls, higher up, was much more attractive because they could guarantee to see the dancers' feet from there. It was very important, whereas opera ticket buyers like to be down in the stalls and look up at the singer. So that's an interesting diversion there. Simon, you've seen Pina. What did you think?
Yeah, no, I wasn't so overwhelmed by the 3D aspect to it, but I thought it was just a very graceful kind of film to watch, and the movement, and it was almost like an attack on your senses in terms of what was shown visually and the grace and the beauty of the dance that took place. But I have to say that I think it could have, for me personally, it could have been a nice 1080p sort of digital file, and it probably still would have transferred the same. I feel like I would have had the same experience. So, but maybe I just need a bit of crash and bash, and things come out and stab me in the eye or something. But that's kind of on its own. I was interested in the thought behind doing it in 3D because I felt that it was still quite a spectacular film on its own.
It's an interesting question, isn't it? Because I watched the trailer again this afternoon preparing for the show, and remembered some of the fabulous scenes from the film, but of course, watching it on YouTube, you're watching it in a small screen and 2D, and I was thinking, well, yeah, that works, still works. Mm. You know, is 3D? Have there been any films in this wave of digital 3D that you feel, Miriam, you really miss out if you watch the 2D version?
I think Herzog's Cave of Forgotten Dreams, there's bits where his film is about filming the cave paintings, and there are parts when you suddenly realise, actually, this is completely different from me looking at a still, or you know, even moving images in 2D, that I'm seeing the contours, and I'm seeing the depth of these paintings, the exact way in which these very beautifully drawn paintings curve around and use, you know, the wall, use the space, it's completely different than something you can actually see in 2D. I did actually, when I was watching it, I kept putting a hand over one eye to see what it looked like in 2D and going, oh no, that's not as good, go back to 3D. So,
yeah, and that's been a great success in 3D. I think it has, you know, it's worthy, it completely deserves it. But I always sometimes feel that it's almost like you need the odd sight gag in a 3D film just to remind you that it is in 3D, that it's not just about the depth, but it's also about the experience of something you know, happening.
I disagree. I actually sort of believe what Ebert was saying about the fact that you're looking at a window frame and you don't need stuff sort of coming out at you to remind you, but actually just to be able to look through the window out into the distance is actually just as much of an affecting 3D vibe, I guess. But that's just me. I know that my sister, for example, she's got no stereoscopic vision, so it's all completely wasted on her. And I know that there are quite a few people around for whom this entire conversation has been a bit of a waste of time, really.
But this is also, for me, it's something similar to maybe good Dolby surround sound, which is that, yeah, you can watch your DVD, you know, on your home computer, and you get a lot out of it. You know, you don't necessarily realise a difference if you've seen it in the cinema. But in the cinema, there's a sensation to it that comes from that amazing sound that just feels at the time like something impressive. I think sometimes that is what 3D is adding, is that little extra that you don't necessarily take home and pinpoint, but you feel it when you're watching it.
Another question for you about 3D how close should you get to the screen to get the sort of optimum experience? Because I know that quite a lot of people that when they're at 3D movies will still try and sit quite a long way back because it's almost too overwhelming.
Well, it's actually meant to be the further back you are in the auditorium, the more that increases the sense of depth in the image. So you actually want to be further back rather than close to the screen.
I didn't know that. Right. But naturally people have sort of worked that out.
I think, I mean, that comes through from stereographers, people who are fans of 3D cinema, and they worked that out, you know, back in the 80s and even back in the 50s. But yeah, there's a sense in which it depends on the cinema screen, depends how far the first seat is away from the actual screen itself. I would say it's not so much about being very close, but you do not want to hit the sides. That's when it starts to get lost in the side of the time.
Right.
Interesting. I always thought it was the middle for me. I had to be in the middle of the cinema with 3D. But you're right, I've experienced the sides and they're not so crash hot sometimes. I remember with Beowulf going up to the screen and having a look again. Walked all around the cinema. I was on my own at the time, so it was all right. Checked everything out.
It just reminds me of those toddlers that I saw at the Smurfs who, you know, when they got bored, just got up and sort of walked up to the front of the screen just to see how it was made. A little bit restless there, Simon, a restless theatre goer. Thank you very much, Miriam Ross, for your time. We've really appreciated your review of Wim Wenders' Pina and hope to have you back here with us on the Cinematica podcast at some future date. And now it's time for Kaylee with the news.
Thank you very much, Dan. So, starting off our news headlines today is another 3D upcoming film. Rumour has it Metallica are planning a 3D feature film. Yeah, is that a yay or a cringe?
I'm not going to be a yay. I think it's spectacular over the top works in 3D.
I don't know if people are at a Metallica concert right now or shortly in Abu Dhabi of all places, so I'm sure they'll like it.
So a 3D version of the stage show, not of their their psychological treatment.
We're not sure. We're not sure if it's going to be a stage show or some sort of like written drama.
It's not just Metallica in an acoustic concert in 3D, is it? You know,
nobody
just
knows.
Oh, it should be animated like Yellow Submarine.
Yes.
Uh, to comedian and funny man Will Ferrell received the Mark Twain Prize, which is a top U.S. humor award, Sunday night.
And I just would like to dispute that particular piece of news here, because in the script that you've given us, you haven't put funny man in inverted commas.
Oh, I think he's funny.
He's funny-ish. Hey, have you seen the landlord on YouTube? He's funny.
Yeah, yeah. 2 minutes. 2 minutes of Will Ferrell goes a very, very long way. Have you seen the other guys?
Yes. Yeah, he's great in that.
Crikey, that's dreadful. Oh. Yeah.
Oh, did you ever see him on Saturday Night Live?
No, because we're here, because what's this podcast called? The Cinematica podcast. It's not called the TV Ticker podcast.
I didn't
podcast.
Like him on Saturday Night Live. Saturday Night's very hit and miss, really. But anyway, we
move on.
Yeah, move on.
Angelina Jolie is making her writer and directorial debut with the already controversial film In the Land of Blood and Honey, and the trailer was revealed today. Did you guys watch it?
No.
Sorry, was a little bit busy, but you're going to put a link in.
Did you send it to us?
No, I thought you could do it yourself.
Oh.
Yeah, you've heard of the Google machine.
Googly.
But perhaps you could put a link in the show notes.
Yes, I will put a link
on the website that we don't have yet.
On our future website, on Facebook. We can launch our Facebook page.
Yes, indeed.
What else? William Shatner is back, and we'll be going to new realms of self-parody. Seeking Major Tom is a two-disc concept album featuring Shatner covering songs that explore the condition of the astronaut from David Bowie's Space Oddity.
When does it come out? When?
It's
when?
Out now.
It's out now. I'm going to get that for Christmas.
For friends and enemies. There are two things I'd like to say to that. One is that I bought his last album and it was fantastic. It really was. It's one of my favourite. There was some, his version of Pulp's Common People is a mixtape favourite for me. I often stick that on CDs for people. The other thing I'd like to add to this particular conversation is...
Is this the real life? Is this just fantasy? Caught in a landslide, no escape from reality. Open your eyes. Look up to the skies. And see.
That's genius. That's just genius.
I think if that is not on your on hold music here at the cinema by next week, Simon, then something will have gone seriously wrong.
Yeah, you're right. I'm going to get that on.
And rounding out the news tonight, Warner Brothers has given the green light to the live action remake of Akira, one of the most celebrated Japanese anime films. The new movie will move the setting from futuristic Tokyo to a futuristic Manhattan, where the leader of a biker gang tries to save his friends with psychokinetic powers from the government. Leo DiCaprio will produce.
I have to say that sounds like every other film that I've seen in the last sort of 10 years. I mean, the thing about Japanese anime is that its anime-ness is what makes it wonderful. You know, the plots are pretty sort of piffling, really, you know, and there's not much character and all that. So the moment you take the design out of them, what have you got left, really? You've just got an ordinary sort of Hollywood blockbuster with a bit of brand recognition.
Give it a break, you know, with Leo on the charge.
The taste meister.
I think Marissa Tomei is rumored. She might be in it. She might not be in it.
Well, that's a 50-50 chance there of some aspect of the film turning out well.
With that hairstyle, you know, you look like you can drag through the bush on the back, right, and your hair's sticking out on the lens, and she'll have that going with Akira, I'm sure. She'll look great.
We've been talking about the film business quite a lot during the program today, and the next subject for review is all about the movie business. It's certainly not about film art.
Katie, Christy, say hi to the camera. Something's going on.
Maybe it is.
Do the knocking game you showed me, remember? How do you do it?
I don't know, ask her.
I really like that trick.
It's not a trick. You've been doing it all day.
There was something in the house. Christy's like connected.
Got a real life poltergeist.
She's like, Carolyn, I just gotta film this stuff. I set up my cameras around the house, right? I can maybe capture something.
Yeah.
Julie, watch. See that?
What? Oh my god. What is going on?
Okay, that was quite a long extract from the trailer for Paranormal Activity 3. But actually, it's entirely appropriate that was a long extract, because that's pretty much how the film is. It's long, long periods of time before the boo moments. And, you know, there were probably only about four really sort of jump out of your skin. Not that I'd do that, because I'm a bit too cool for that sort of stuff. But there are only probably three or four really sort of big boo moments in the film. The other thing that was really noticeable when I was looking at the trailer again to grab some audio for today's program is that three quarters, maybe even more, of that trailer doesn't appear in the film.
Yeah,
it's a completely.
Oh, okay. It's one of those.
It's a completely. It's like they've made a trailer for the film that they wanted to make, and then somebody at the studio has gone, "Phew, no, you can't do that. This is a Paranormal Activity film. There are certain rules you have to, you know, don't leave the house, all those sorts of things." So it's a completely different film. It's that somebody should sue.
We'll just throw that out there for everyone.
Yeah, for those people that were lucky enough to listen to
it. To just people out there.
Indeed. So for those people who don't know, Paranormal Activity is a series of films that all have an identical premise. A house is haunted. The male parental figure in the house just happens to have a whole lot of either video cameras or web cameras or what have you, and decides that he's going to get to the bottom of this mystery by putting cameras all over the house. And we then get to see either the security camera footage or the footage that's been left behind after everybody's sort of met their demise as a result of this poltergeist. I've seen all three of them now. Actually, I'll just take that, rewind that just a moment or so, because I actually couldn't see the first two all the way through to the end because they were so bad. So bad.
You were just cowering behind your chair and you missed the end.
Heck no. This is just really shabby storytelling. The very first Paranormal Activity film cost $15,000 to make. It was sort of an experiment. A guy literally used his own webcams and his own gear, his own house, and just made it to see whether he could make it work. And then he made $100 million, or rather the studio made $100 million. So why wouldn't you go back to the well? Paranormal Activity 2 was a remake. It wasn't even a prequel or a sequel, really. It was effectively the same film, just in earlier on in time. Paranormal Activity 3 is, again, effectively the same film. It's they've gone back in time again, set in 1988. And...
Are you looking forward to Paranormal Activity
4? You know, it's one of those things that makes the job that I do, like, really quite painful. It's equally painful in discovering that it's made, like, $40 million in its first weekend, and I don't really know quite how to deal with the economics of that, because it just seems to me that, as a reviewer, I'm completely redundant. I have absolutely no influence. My review of Paranormal Activity comes out in tomorrow's paper, and it's too late. It's already done whatever business it's going to do. So,
but as a genre on its own, like, you know, as a it's not art, but it's got a job to do, and it goes out and does it. Doesn't it hit the right audience? Doesn't it hit that younger audience that gets that fright, that gets involved?
It does. It's the equivalent of the carnival ghost train. You know, is that you ride around and you're waiting and you're waiting and you're waiting, and then
cool?
Somebody goes, "But yeah," and that's actually film was invented as a circus trick and a carnival sideshow, and even films like Avatar are still basically roller coaster rides in terms of how the impact that they have on an audience. So no, I don't really have a problem with that. There were a few people in the audience of the screening that I was at on Saturday morning, including two 10-year-old boys on their own, who were very, very excited about what they were about to watch. And I overheard one of them say to the other, "Oh, I hope I don't piss myself." No, I think they were a little bit disappointed. I think they certainly were very sort of hyper by the end of the film, because the last sort of 5 or 10 minutes, it really does go to town. But there's a lot of build up, and there's a lot of weight.
Isn't that funny? Like, you know, when I was 10, I would have had to have snuck into a film like that. There's no way I could have gone and seen it as a 10-year-old. I would have, you know, it would have been rated, and you would have had to have. Snuck.
Yeah, so it's exactly right. Paranormal Activity 3 in New Zealand is rated M, which means there's no restriction, which means that kids of any age pretty much can just sort of wander in. They've got the money.
And there'll be some parents out there after that night after you watched it.
Yeah, kids, that's kids.
Until 3 and with, you know, like waking up with the terrors.
Yeah, yeah. And,
possibly.
And some deeply sort of deformed psychologies as a result of it. It's been a quiet week for movie reviews. We've done all three that we were going to talk about. So it's we're sort of time to wind this show up.
I want the truth. You can't handle the truth.
And the truth is what you've got more or less here on the Cinematica podcast, episode 2. I'd like to thank our guest, Miriam Ross, for coming in to talk to us about 3D and about Pina. Thank you very much. Hope to see you again here on the podcast soon. If you've enjoyed this episode, make sure you leave some feedback on the iTunes store. You can find us on iTunes now. Ratings and reviews are super useful to help more people discover the show. You can also contact us via Twitter. Our Twitter handle is CinematicaCast. If you search for us on Facebook, there'll be a Facebook page up very shortly. And by the end of the week, touch wood, there'll be a finished website at cinematica.co.nz.
We're going
to
are. So what have I got to see this week?
Next week's program, we are going to be discussing the Inbetweeners movie.
Whoa.
You've been looking forward to that. You've been looking forward to that all month.
I've seen it.
I hate it when you two have seen films and I haven't. There's something very wrong about that. We're also going to be talking about In Time, which is made by Andrew Niccol, the New Zealand director who made Gattaca. Fright Night, there's a new version of that coming out for Halloween. And there's also another film called One Day. Is that the romantic comedy? Is that the Anne Hathaway?
Yeah, that's, you're right there, Governor. That's what she does an all right there, Governor.
She does an English accent. Mm. And so we'll be marking her out of 10 for her English accent next week on the Cinematica podcast. And that's it for us. The closing music is from the Pedro Almodovar film Talk to Her, which also featured Pina Bausch and her dance. That was from 2002, I think. And I was looking it up while I was looking for music for Pina, and I thought, ooh, I haven't heard this for a long time. So we'll just fade out while this is playing in the background. The show is executive produced by Simon Wherry.
Good night.
It's produced by me, Dan Slevin. The news is curated by Kaylee Carruthers.
I'm also your webmaster.
Our theme music is 6x6 by Earl Van Dyke, and you can buy that at the iTunes store. We're going to leave you with this music from the soundtrack of Almodovar's Talk to Her. This is Raquel by a group called Bao. So it's good night from all of us, and we'll see you at the same time next week. You can remember to click download and subscribe so that you get all the episodes when they become available. Cheerio. Till next time.